And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
As Labor Day weekend approaches, we're going to give you a lot to choose from with all that weekend holiday leisure time. We take a quick look at what's happening in the Grand Sequoias, then off on one of the greatest adventures as we follow a caribou herd, and then we start unlocking the secrets of the wisdom of the great apes. It's the best nature talk show in the world. Keep on the path as the Wild Side News takes you where you always want to go.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News, and now, Sydney Wildsmith.
We're heading for a wrap on summer vacation. I'm already hearing the whispers from some that it seems summers keep speeding up, and perhaps we're beginning to associate late summer with the beginning of hurricane season, and things are beginning to speed up there, as Hurricane Ernesto makes a less than sensational stand and heads on up into the Carolinas. As the news media scrambles to find a new sensation after the JonBenet case fell off the screen, the world of hurricanes actually is beefing up for yet another real season. A couple of weeks ago, China had the worst cyclone in 50 years, and as we speak, the Baja is getting ripped up by Hurricane John. So keep in mind, hurricane season is not just a U.S. phenomenon. In many respects, this is becoming another big storm year. As Ernesto fizzles, that's good news. So too, the oil prices that were poised to jump back up if the storm headed into the Gulf. Some more good news is that oil prices are reaching a new low for this season, as some predict a return to the mid-60s. By the way, what happened to the BP pipeline factor? So, things seem to be returning to normal, kind of. We've got three great stories coming up. Following the news, we're up to the Great Sequoia Redwood Forests to explore the recent decision by a federal judge to back the demands of the Sierra Club that the world's most significant collection of Grand Sequoias not be given over to the new Forest Service management practices that would have cut down the old growth to keep them from burning. And then in segment two, every once in a while, the Wild Side News takes you on an extended journey. We've gone in depth and spent an entire show following a great story. We've brought you some truly exceptional immersions. Well, we want to be sure you get a sense of what these journeys are like. So today, we're bringing you two teasers that may spark your interest in hearing the rest of the story. So in segment two, we introduce you to one of our longest such adventures as we follow the plans of two wildly adventurous newlyweds who spent their first months of marriage heading off on foot to follow the secret journey of the porcupine caribou herd from their summer range in Canada to their calving area in the legendary Arctic Wildlife Refuge. You'll hear the words of the adventurer himself, Carsten Hauer, and may just be inclined to want to keep on going along with him and his wife as they finish the tale. And then you'll find out what drives a legendary researcher in search of the intelligence of apes from its roots in a raw research lab with monkeys trying to figure out what in the world was supposed to happen to the moment when the researcher himself realized he had missed the amazing intelligence of his subjects and totally transformed his approach. We give you two entrees to adventure in this special sampler edition of the Wild Side News. It's all coming up following the news. So now, the news. 100 African elephants were found dead in five separate killing grounds in Chad, not far from the border of Sudan, which has experienced its own human massacre for years. The discoveries were made near Chad's Zakouma National Park, one of the animal's most northern ranges in Central Africa. Wildlife groups say a rise in illicit ivory sales globally is being driven by a new demand from China. an expedition in 2005 counted 3,885 elephants in Zakuma, but a year later, researchers found just over 3,000. The park is located in the path of recent rebel activity in Chad, which has reduced the security in the area, which would otherwise have protected the animals. And in Alaska, two conservation groups filed a lawsuit to stop the killing of native wolves, which has been sanctioned by the Alaska State Board of Game. Over 550 wolves have been killed so far. The season on wolves was authorized reportedly to help increase the caribou and moose population, which proponents of the culling claim have been reduced due to overpopulation of wolves and bears, which kill the young. Critics of the hunt say it is aimed at wiping out more than 80% of wolves in a large section of Alaska to benefit mostly urban hunters who want an easy time getting to the moose and caribou. Defenders of wildlife claim that the claims about diminishing caribou and moose populations is based on faulty science. Under the program, the state issues permits which allow pilots and gunners to shoot wolves from the air or to spot them, land, and shoot them. Numbers for this year's hunt have not been set. No, the Center for Animal Transgenesis is not something out of a Jurassic Park remake. It is a program administered by the University of Pennsylvania Medical School, which has recently demonstrated that rat sperm cells transplanted into mice testicles can produce viable rat sperm that has successfully fathered healthy rats through micro-insemination with female rat eggs. Pay attention. So what's this mean? It gets even stranger, kind of. One application holds the potential for healthy sperm to be grown in donor testes of other animals, thus advancing the science of endangered species management. And it also means that much food could be saved by growing sperm from, let's say, male cattle in, for example, mice testes. And so it goes. It could lead to the effective elimination of most male humans, as human sperm could be grown in, well, we'll just have to wait and see just how far-reaching this new transgenesis project may lead. Researchers making recordings of a lone killer whale in the Nootka Sound area of Vancouver Island have announced that the animal effectively mimicked the sound of an adult sea lion, thus proving that killer whales can learn to produce unorca-like sounds, a feat considered rare among mammals. Unfortunately, the ability to study this unique vocal vocabulary was terminated when Luna, the friendly whale, was struck and killed by a tugboat propeller in March. Luna is fondly remembered as a friendly whale that followed boats and interacted with local residents. Her legacy will be forever held as advancement in science of animal behavior. And in Manila, 15,000 prisoners are having their heads shaved bald in response to a national emergency. No, they are not being prepared for extermination due to prison budget cuts. Rather, they are answering a call from the Philippine government to amass tons of hair and feathers to absorb more than 50,000 gallons of industrial fuel that leaked from a tanker when it sank off the central island of Guaymas in mid-August. Barbershops and salons are getting into the environmental cleanup effort by saving their clippings, while schools are asking students as well to shave their heads bald to help in the environmental cleanup efforts. Environmentalism has a shiny new look in the Philippines. And that's the news. And a few reminders. Next week, a very special show all about the new resurgence of a sense of wilderness that's bringing people together across the country. We bring you three voices for the wilderness as plans are being made to head to Washington, D.C. for Wilderness Week in the nation's capital. It's a show you'll definitely want to tune into. So now, let's head on out to California's Grand Sequoia and Redwood Country, where the battles to keep the grandest living things standing is seeing some grand success. Last week, a federal judge in San Francisco made a ruling that challenges a lot of the Bush administration's strategies for forest management. And in this particular case, it had to do with a decision that related to the giant Sequoia National Monument. Joining us from San Francisco is an attorney who worked on that with the Sierra Club, Pat Gallagher. Pat, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you.
Why don't you give us a little history about Giant Sequoia National Monument? It truly is a unique spot. President Clinton established this in 2000. It's a relatively large monument, 328,000 acres. Why don't you take it from there in terms of giving us a sense of the significance of this particular public land?
Probably the most significant aspect of it is that it contains somewhere between a half and two-thirds of all the giant sequoias in the world. Giant sequoias only grow in a narrow band in the Sierra Nevada Mountains. As folks probably know, they're the largest plant organism on the face of the earth. They're actually bigger in bulk than the coastal redwoods, even though they're not quite as tall. They're this incredibly magnificent species of tree, and the monument contains about 30 or 40, I don't know the exact number, distinct groves of sequoias, and then interspersed with that, huge belts of sugar pine, white fir, and then quite a bit of chaparral, caves, beautiful river canyons, tons of wildlife. So the whole thing is just a spectacular setting. And it's actually sandwiched in between Kings Canyon and Sequoia National Park. So, you know, it's a real treasure. It's not only a national treasure, you know, given that this is the only place on Earth they grow. It's a worldwide treasure.
Why was this not set up as part of the national park system originally?
Well, the park itself was set up around the turn of the century. And I just think that expectations and ambitions were, you know, a little bit less dramatic back at that time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the resources to manage such a big area just weren't there.
Mm-hmm. But there was pressure to have this set aside as a national monument, and it was Bill Clinton, President Clinton, did that in 2000. And this does obviously provide certain protections, therefore, from logging. However, as we know, many of these various regulations and mandates are continually being chiseled away at by the Bush administration, who is kind of changing the law by changing management strategies. This became part of the Healthy Forest Initiative. That was sort of the way in which they began to feel that they were doing the right thing by logging.
The Bush administration has promoted commercial logging in the guise of fire management.
Correct.
And it's a real hoax on the American people.
It is a concession to the timber industry. So in this particular case, actually logging had begun.
It's a little bit complicated, so let me back up a few steps.
Sure.
So the monument was created in April of 2000. And when Clinton created the monument, he carved out an exception for what, for lack of a better word, we'll call grandfathered timber sales. These are timber sales that had been approved in the late 90s, right before the monument was created. And he said in the monument proclamation that those could go forward on the terms that were in existence at that time.
Well, that's challenging.
Right. So there was a few thousand acres of logging that kind of got grandfathered in. But the idea was that logging was necessary to transition the local mill for a couple of years, like, you know, through 2002 or whatever, so that they could then, you know, move into some sort of new source of timber or, you know, retool themselves to deal with different size wood. But what happened was during that time period, and we're talking, you know, circa 2001, timber prices were really depressed. So what happened was the industry just sat on those timber sales. They didn't act on them. And then, so basically did not log the area. And then fast forward to 2005, 5 years later, after the monument was created, and the Bush administration passed this broader management plan for prospective management, not the grandfathered sales, but all the new commercial logging that they were going to do. So we geared up to sue to challenge that prospective plan, and then all of a sudden we found out from some local citizens down there that they were already logging, and so obviously, you know, we were kind of dumbfounded. And then we found out that what they had done is they had resurrected the grandfathered sales that they never acted on, and that they decided, well, they better cut them now. So we marched into court and sought preliminary injunctions, TROs, to stop that logging.
Now, is that against the logging companies, per se?
No, it's all Forest Service. The Forest Service is the defendant in all the cases because they are the they're the agency that's approving the action.
All right, gotcha.
The timber companies basically just sign a contract with the Forest Service to buy the timber from them.
Okay.
So technically, there's kind of two pieces to this lawsuit. One was going after the grandfathered sales, and then the other piece, which is in some respects the more major piece, is stopping this prospective plan that deals with all 300 and some odd thousand acres of the monument. And so the rationale for stopping the grandfathered sales was that Fish and Wildlife Service in 2004, so just a couple of years ago, acknowledged that the Pacific fisher, which is a cousin of the wolverine, it's a very rare mammal that lives in the monument, was on the verge of extinction, and that it really needed draconian protection. And the grandfathered timber sales that we challenged were based on all this outdated science from the mid-90s with respect to the Pacific fisher. So we came in and said, well, you can't cut in 2005 after your own agency has determined that this animal is on the verge of extinction and just ignore all that science. You're going to drive this animal, you know, into oblivion. And the judge agreed with us on that. So he shut down all the grandfathered timber sales on that basis. Mm-hmm. They don't offer enough protection for this rare animal.
Mm-hmm. Besides the grandfathered timber sales, there hadn't really been an effort to expand and kind of use the Healthy Forest Initiative to promote thinning within the groves.
Well, no, they couldn't do that until the monument plan was free and clear and finally approved. And they had started to develop some projects under the new monument plan. The first one that we were worried about was something called the Whitaker Project. And that was a project they were actually going to go into one of the Sequoia Groves, the Redwood Mountain Grove. And they were going to cut trees up to 30 inches in diameter, which are, you know, huge trees by today's standards. These forests have been so cut over that a 30-inch diameter tree, I mean, just hearing that in the abstract is kind of hard to imagine, but sometime if you're out in the forest and you go up to a tree and get a sense of how big a tree is, if it's 30 inches across the middle of the trunk, that's a huge tree.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, and so this Whitaker Project called for the cutting of trees up to 30 inches in diameter, and so we protested loudly and submitted all kinds of comments at the so-called scoping stage of that. And what happened was, because of this litigation, they just kind of put that project on ice. So nothing has really happened as far as the prospective management and the kind of thinning that they, you know, were planning to do. And now with this latest ruling, everything's back to the drawing board.
This concept of the thinning that is behind the Healthy Forest Initiative, in an ancient grove like this, where you have such towering, massive trees, I don't know that the science would support that is a legitimate way to prevent forest fires. These trees have been around for thousands of years and have adapted themselves to withstand forest fires with foot to 2 foot bark. Were you able to use any of that type of science to make your case?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to say about this topic. I mean, the first message that I always want to get across is that the Sierra Club and all of our allies, nobody's interested in having towns and houses burn up. You know, everybody's interested in having communities be protected. But we believe, and there's science to back it up, that they're actually increasing the risk of fire. And the reason for that is the kind of logging that's called for. When you go in and you log 30-inch trees, and you reduce the forest canopy, which is essentially the shade layer overhead, when you reduce that pretty dramatically, you end up with a much hotter, drier environment, and you end up with a lot of debris on the ground, and then you end up with a lot of bushy undergrowth growing up because the sunlight's penetrating to the floor. That's prime fire conditions. That's how big fires start, is with hot, dry surface fuel. So we have won, actually, a number of cases in the last couple of years where the judges have recognized that logging large trees and opening up and drying out the forest not only doesn't prevent fire, it actually exacerbates fire.
I am a scientist, but there's only so much that I can know. And when I think about thinning in a forest, I typically think of removing lower brush. But I guess in this particular case, the way that this is being interpreted and and actually happening in the field, is thinning means taking out large trees.
You know, the way that I tend to think of it, and I can't say that this is exactly true in all instances. I think what's happening is that you've got the Forest Service having mixed intentions. They've got, you know, partly benevolent intentions. I mean, they're interested in controlling fires, so they want to get in there and they want to clear out the small diameter stuff, the brush, the undergrowth, which is really the problem, the fuel for forest fires. But they don't have the money to do that. So where are they going to get the money? Well, the way they get the money is they sell the big trees. So one odd analogy that I've used is it's like selling one of your organs, like selling a kidney to pay for your health club membership. So they're selling the heart of the forest so that they can clean up the forest. It really makes no sense at all.
This actually changes my perception of what was being done, and thanks for educating me, in the sense that thinning actually means taking out large timber. Therefore, as you say, that canopy is gone and suddenly everything, the whole ecosystem is radically changed.
Right. There's a couple other, I think, key points to make on this front. One is that what we're pushing for is that the monument be managed just like the national park is managed. And then again, the national park is right next door. And the National Park Service has developed methods for using prescribed fire, where you do controlled burns and you burn out the sort of the spindly undergrowth and the surface fuels, and very selective thinning, and no logging of large trees. And the Park Service is incredibly successful. They've really learned how to manage fire. They've got a really healthy forest. They've got great regeneration of sequoia trees. So that's the model. And I think the Forest Service is gradually sort of being dragged, kicking and screaming, to that model. And I hope that this lawsuit victory, you know, kind of moves them further in that direction. And then the other key, I think, point for the audience to understand is that the giant sequoia ecosystem actually needs fire. Giant sequoia cones will not germinate, will not open and spread their seeds unless they're subject to fire. So it's an ecosystem that actually evolved with fire. And so to remove fire from that ecosystem, you know, would be the height of folly.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's many pines in particular where that's exactly the process, and it's a requirement. Well, this is also is interesting in the sense that apparently there must be different management policies for national monuments versus national parks. Am I right about that in terms of this concept of allowing these logging management practices?
Yeah, well, obviously, the National Park Service is not in the business of selling timber. The Forest Service is. And unfortunately, this national monument is under the management of the Forest Service. I mean, that's the real problem.
So part of your effort, then, in terms of the Sierra Club and others and people who are concerned about the sequoia trees, if anybody hasn't seen a sequoia or a redwood, it's life-critical that you go see these things because it changes your perspective on many different things. And there are many people who really appreciate the extraordinary significance of every single tree. You can really sense that to lose one of these grand old trees that have been around in some cases for thousands of years, it's hard for me to comprehend that we can let something like that go. Really, the best protection, then, is to have this somehow transferred over to the National Park Service.
Yeah, I mean, that would be ideal. And at a minimum, managed exactly like the Park Service manages it.
What's the prospect of that? What's involved in that process?
Oh, that would probably require action by Congress or some sort of, you know, interagency agreement between the Forest Service and the Park Service. And that's a campaign that's just getting started, and that we hope to promote over the next couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Now, if people wanted to help in that process, what would you recommend?
They should visit the Sierra Club website. If they visit our page, which is Sierra Club /environmental law, and they can send us an email, and we can put them in touch with people that are working on the campaign.
Do you think that this particular ruling is going to hold in terms of this lawsuit concerning Giant Sequoia National Monument?
Oh, sure. And I think that it's so well-reasoned and decisive that it would be a real mistake for them to even try to appeal.
Well, Pat Gallagher, attorney with the Sierra Club, who's been prime in terms of getting this ruling in favor of the Giant Sequoia National Monument. Good work. If there's anything that I can do, please let me know.
Okay, my pleasure.
Okay, get ready for adventure as we start two journeys that explore the depths of our world when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Here's a little secret you may already know. The Wildside News is actually more than a radio show. It's your own private on-demand source to the amazing people who are researching, adventuring, braving the unknown. Anytime you're ready, you can choose where you want to go next. Coming up, segment one of just such an adventure as two newlywed adventurers set off to find out what it means to be caribou.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
You are about to hear one of the most amazing stories of adventure of the 21st century. In April 2003, Carsten Hoyer and his bride Leanne set out on an Arctic trek to follow the legendary porcupine caribou herd from the wintering grounds in northern Canada, over 500 miles of frozen trails, biting blizzards, grizzlies, in a test of human endurance, to find out what being caribou really is. The story drives home to our modern world, better than any of recent times, why the preservation of the calving areas located on the coastal tundra of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge must be recognized and held sacred for the soul of the wild creatures, who will tell us their story as enacted each year for the past 27,000 years through this amazing story of being caribou. This is a special edition of the Wildside News. I empower you to come along during the next 2 hours so that you too can come to know what being caribou is all about. And so the journey begins. Today I was listening to the President speak about the emerging global war on terror, and it just seems sometimes that the stresses of our world are overwhelming at times, and the challenges are enormous, and it's hard to find our way. And even the global war on terror oftentimes can be associated with, at least according to some people, the demands that are being placed on our future for issues such as oil in particular. And these issues then translate right into the ground here, including stresses potentially on places like Anwar, where oil becomes the issue, quite honestly, at least from the perspective of our own national security. And so the answers to these questions become very complex. And sometimes it's very hard to find our way. But every once in a while, a person emerges who decides to challenge these kinds of future visions with a whole different way of looking at things and trying to find out different levels of truth. And joining us today is an extraordinary person, Carsten Hoyer, who has written a book recently called Being Caribou, just out by the great people at Mountaineers Books. Carsten, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thanks a lot, Sydney.
Being Caribou is a story of an adventure that you and your wife took on, where you decided that you were going to find out what it meant to be caribou and we're going to talk at length about that. But first, let's talk a little bit about you and your background that kind of helped to lead to this extraordinary challenge. So give us a background on kind of, first of all, about your career and your experience.
Sure. So right now I'm living in Canada. We live in British Columbia, sort of north central. On one side of the valley where we live is the Canadian Rockies, and on the other side is the Caribou Mountains. And through the course of the last 10 years of my life, I've taken my biological training, so my degree in ecology, and applied it both to work in wildlife biology in countries as far and wide as Slovakia and Poland and South Africa, and as close as to home as Jasper National Park and Banff National Park in Alberta, and as far north as Avavik National Park, which is the extreme northwest corner of Canada's Yukon Territory. And so it borders directly onto Alaska and the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And so I was posted up there over the past few years. And having grown up in a very different environment in the city of Calgary, which would be very, very much like, to Denver, for instance, in terms of geography, out on the plains, but very close to the Rocky Mountains, you know, definitely below tree line. But to me, the Arctic environment before I went up there on this assignment as a park ranger was very foreign, and I didn't really know what to expect. I mean, I certainly had some ideas and some notions and some dreams of what I'd like to see and what I'd like to experience. But when I got up there, I set off on my first patrol of this national park, which is very remote. The nearest town is hundreds of miles away, so we would fly in with a small plane with tundra tires, land on the Arctic tundra, throw out two inflatable rafts, and we would raft down Interior River of this national park for 10 days. And that was how we would conduct our park patrols. Well, the very first patrol that I did in spring 2001, and spring in the Arctic is kind of late June, we encountered this caribou herd of 123,000 animals that was crossing through the park, swimming across this river, on its way to their calving grounds, their preferred calving ground on the coastal plain of Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And this herd of 123,000 animals, I mean, it's not like watching elk in Yellowstone National Park pass in front of your vehicle, or, you know, a few deer in the Maine woods pass in front of your house or your tent camp. This went on for 2 full days and 2 full nights of animals coursing across this river, and not only the caribou, but all the animals and all the life that they tow along that Arctic landscape with them. So that this huge sort of tundra landscape of rolling hills and mountains and this deep river canyon had virtually been silent before the caribou started arriving, and all of a sudden it was just throbbing with life. At one point we saw 8 grizzly bears, you know, in various stages of being downstream, hoping for some caribou that didn't make it across to wash up. Others lying in the bushes waiting in ambush to scare caribou that were coming out of the water. We saw wolves, foxes, golden eagles dive bombing down, peregrine falcons. I mean, it was just amazing. And then after 2 days, and again, you know, this is all from the perspective of somebody who's never experienced anything like this before, except maybe, you know, through the written word in stories about what it used to be like on the plains where I grew up in Calgary with a bison. And this is really that level of life still up in the Arctic. And so after 2 days of being immersed in this and not being able to sleep because of all the dramas that were constantly unfolding around us, the last few hundred animals climbed up over the ridge and disappeared to the west. And after having been a part of that energy and part of that power, it was really hard to kind of be left in its wake, in its silent wake. And a huge part of me wanted to go with it, to follow those animals over that ridge and to continue to observe and feel the events that would unfold as they continued to pass across the landscape. And also to satisfy curiosity, like, where the heck were these animals going, and why were they traveling with such motivation and such force across this landscape, so focused on getting somewhere. Where was that place and why was it important? And so those are the questions that sort of swam around in my head as I continued on my patrol north down the river, and then we got picked up on the Arctic Ocean and flew back to the park headquarters office, which is in the nearest town of Inuvik in the Northwest Territories. And I got back, and, you know, part of this caribou herd was still inside me, rattling around, and it led me to books, to reports, to past television documentaries, to find out. I mean, I was just thirsty for knowledge to find out more about this caribou herd. And that's when I learned about where they were headed, was their preferred calving grounds on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, an area that, by, you know, the best archaeological estimate, that they've been going back to year after year for at least the last 27,000 years. And I learned about this proposal that's been swimming around in the background and debated in very hotly contested issues. Most Americans know, probably the largest environmental issue in all of the U.S. right now, of this proposal to drill for oil in the exact place where this caribou herd goes to have their calves every year. And so that really sort of interested me, concerned me, and I started thinking, wow, like, do people know? Do people understand that it's this amount of life, that it's this concentrated life that's heading to that place? And I wanted to really share those feelings, those initial powerful feelings I've had of the caribou, and let it be known, because I think one of the greatest tragedies in the world would be if we sacrifice something or compromise something or lose something without ever really understanding what's there that we've lost. And I think that would be a great tragedy in terms of this caribou herd and Arctic refuge. So I started thinking about how to bring this story alive for people. And I got talking to my wife, Leanne Allison, who's, you know, a very accomplished adventurer, mountaineer in her own right, and we'd both done a trip a couple years before, walking from Yellowstone up to the Yukon, to try to bring alive the story of wildlife that need to travel between parks and reserves and wildlife corridors. And we thought, could we do something like that with the caribou? Could we help to bring their story alive? And so over a period of months, this idea began to hatch of trying to be caribou, trying to travel like this caribou herd, travel with the caribou herd, and experience everything they do, the wolf pack encounters, the half-frozen river crossings, the blizzards, the hordes of bugs that emerge in early summer, and experience everything that they go through to get to the calving grounds and back to their winter range again, and in that way try to sort of articulate the caribou's voice, try to articulate the value of the Arctic refuge that up till now we've always been talking about in barrels of oil, billions of barrels of oil, when in fact the caribou's voice has gone unheard. So we thought the value would be in everything they go through to get there and back again.
Well, now there's some challenges here. First of all, I'm just trying to imagine how it is that you happen to find a mate who would tolerate such a vision. Did you ever discuss this when you got... when you got married? Listen, is it possible that you want to accompany me on some of the most extraordinarily difficult challenges that you'll ever face as a human being?
Well, isn't that the vow that everybody takes in marriage?
I don't think so. No.
Well, I mean, Leanne and I have quite a long history. In fact, we first met when we were 5 years old in kindergarten.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
You know, we go back a fair ways, and we kind of fell out of contact with one another for about 13 years. Huh. And then it so happened in university, I was working as a canoe instructor for one of her best friends. And after I'd been working for 2 weeks, her friend, who was my boss for that summer, called Leanne up and said, "You got to come down to this canoe club and meet this guy that's working for me. He's like the male version of you."
That's funny.
So we met, you know, over a decade later, and we kind of led these parallel lives in terms of interests. And a lot of those interests did revolve around traveling in the outdoors and adventuring. And so I think we really are kindred spirits. And so, you know, immediately when I started to think of this idea, Leanne's response wasn't thinking of all why we shouldn't do it. She was really excited about the reasons why we should. And we certainly, you know, over the many months and, in fact, a full year of preparations that it took to get ready for this trip, we certainly encountered a lot of sort of naysayers or people trying to dissuade us from even trying to do this. And quite frankly, there were tons of unknowns. I mean, most of the time when you set off on a trip, and certainly on our Yellowstone to Yukon expedition, this was the case, you make a route plan. You know, you decide, okay, I'm gonna travel here, this valley, go along this ridge, and you sit down with, you know, hundreds of maps, and you work it all out, the distances, the elevation gained and lost, where you would put food caches, how long it's gonna take you, and you develop a schedule and goals and destinations. And this trip with the caribou really, you know, we sort of started heading down that road in our minds. It's like, wait a minute. We don't know where these caribou are going to go because, quite frankly, their migration routes change from one year to the next, both in timing and route. I mean, they could take one mountain range from the Yukon up to Alaska one year and completely switch to another one the next year. And they might even start up one and then kind of change their mind halfway through because of whether it's snow or weather or other things we don't even understand. And adopt an entirely different route. And so there's a huge amount of unpredictability and lack of things to hang the future on for us. And I think that became the biggest challenge as we started to prepare for this trip is all the unknowns, all the unpredictability that we were going to head out into. And so we couldn't put one food cache in before we left. We didn't know if we were heading for off for 4 months or 6 months or 7 months. And we had to put all our faith in these wild animals as our guides and really sort of surrender ourselves to all their whims.
That, to me, in reading your book, was one of the most amazingly difficult things to perceive, is how, as a couple or an individual, but this was a couple, you make the decision to head out on an uncharted course. And as well, not just an uncharted course, but an uncharted course through some extraordinarily difficult terrain. I know that you did a lot of research in terms of there have been radio collared studies of the caribou movements, and so you had a concept of where they go historically and how they might travel. But to head out into that terrain with everything on your back, you know, how did you prepare? I mean, let's talk a little bit about kind of the technical side, the gear side of this. How did you imagine, what did you put in your pack? How did you make those decisions? Because those had to be extremely difficult decisions.
No, they were. And I joke in the book, in the prologue, that sort of our collective Arctic experience amounted to a couple months. And most of those experiences were on a well-stocked raft, river raft, running down a river. So it's a completely different idea when you start thinking about traveling overland. And really all Leanne and I had to tap into were our mountaineering skills. And so we really did put, I mean, we considered a lot of different options, Sydney, but what we really decided in the end is because we have to be able to sort of pack up and go at a moment's notice when the caribou start to move, or if they stop, we have to be able to pitch this tent. You know, it has to be very quick to set up. It has to be portable. It has to be light, so that we don't get tired from carrying excessive weight. And we have to be able to pitch it on a rocky ridge or in a swamp or absolutely anywhere. We sort of melded sort of mountaineering technology with this unorthodox notion of following a wild herd of animals across the tundra. And so we dried all our own food. We packaged it up into, I guess, balls, for lack of a better word of describing it, that were wrapped with tape and garbage bags and crushed newspaper for padding, and then had those all sitting in a warehouse at one town on the Canadian side and another town on the Alaskan side, where we could call in for them as we were going, as we were running out of food. We'd call in to have them delivered by bush plane and dropped out of the sky, essentially, to our location. We would communicate that over a satellite phone, but all of a sudden, okay, we're going to take a satellite phone, so now we have to have some way, means of charging it over these many months. And so that led to, you know, a whole other arm of research into the latest solar panels and recharging technologies. And then once we had that kind of figured out, we thought, well, if we got some battery power, maybe we can do some filming of this trip as well. And so that led to a whole thing where Leanne actually headed off on a week-long course in filmmaking, and you know, to her incredible credit, not only did this trip, but pulled off an award-winning film about the journey as well.
Well, there were lots of decisions. I mean, it's one thing to take off cross-country with a heavy pack. And by the way, what kind of weight were you each carrying?
It really varied depending on how recently we received a food supply. So mm-hmm. right after a food supply, you know, our packs weighed somewhere in the order of 60 to 70 pounds.
Those are very heavy packs.
Yeah, and at one point, you know, when we, I don't know if you remember the book, we're in the sort of heart of the post-calving rush. We're just doing all we can to keep up. And in order to avoid having to wait for a plane to come in, we actually carried a whole month of food. So that was 90 pounds once you added up the month of food and all our equipment.
But here's the thing that now, this is the thing. So you got these heavy packs, but you're also going through snow and over mountain passes, and that's as strenuous as it gets.
Yeah, and we really didn't have a good sense, I think, of what the snow conditions were going to be like before we left. And part of the reason the caribou migrate south after they calve is they're trying to get back below tree line, so latitudinal tree line, before the winter winds hit. Because what the winter winds do is they take the snow, and there's not tons of snow, but there's enough snow, and it just packs it to concrete-like consistency out on the open tundra. So the caribou can't dig down to get at their food, so they migrate down below tree line to spend the winter, where the trees, although they're kind of these stubby, small, short trees, not anything like we're used to down south here, but these trees still do provide enough shelter that the snow remains very soft, and so the caribou can crater down. Well, it makes for great feeding for the caribou in winter, but it makes for horrendous traveling. I mean, it's kind of like walking through this sugar-like consistency of snow that collapsed underneath you. So when we started out from the Porcupine River, which is kind of the northern extent of their winter range, it's still treed in that area, and we set off, you know, presuming that we could just sort of ski in the wake of this caribou herd. And what we found was, even with these long, 8-foot-long skis, our weight was enough that we would just plunge through right to the ground. There was absolutely no support in the snowpack. And so we were wallowing, and within minutes of leaving that very first day, and already overwhelmed with the whole notion of sort of heading off into this great unknown on this uncharted route, and not knowing even how many months we were going to head off for, we sort of make the realization within the first few minutes that we're not even going to be able to travel for the first while in the way we'd assumed we would. We were carrying our skis and having to walk in the trenches that the caribou had left behind, you know, very much like balancing along a narrow, slippery log for kilometer after kilometer. It's very exhausting.
That type of snow is impossible because it's there is no traction. I've been in that, and it's as difficult as it is. You just each foot just sinks. Yeah,
it's kind of like walking on frozen ball bearings to some extent.
Yeah.
But you know what? It was a neat thing too, because immediately we just had to. The only way forward was to follow exactly in the caribou's footsteps. So it became very metaphorical, you know, how much even we had to give up our notions of how we're going to do the trip right in the first few minutes. All of a sudden we're carrying these skis instead of using them. Now that all changed
mm-hmm.
as we did break out of tree line over the first few weeks, and we hit that concrete
first few weeks. I like that.
No, yeah.
let's talk about that timing, because timing was a very critical thing. I mean, you were on foot. This wasn't the National Geographic expedition where you're kind of the helicopters drop you. They have search teams and they drop you within 500 yards of your the herd. You guys had to leave from a point and then try to find the caribou, which all by itself was a challenge, and try to catch up to them and then follow them. And we're going to talk about that takeoff point. But let's talk how it is that you came to decide literally when to leave. I mean, that's a big decision. Timing is critical.
Yes, no, certainly. And that would set up whether or not the whole journey was successful. And so the big question for us was, are these caribou kind of milling around their winter range, or are they starting to migrate? And we didn't want to leave too early because if they weren't migrating yet, we would expend sort of our valuable energy and food and enthusiasm at kind of going in circles following these caribou and not sort of heading towards their calving grounds. So the timing was critical, but even from the biologist reports and the radio caller data and everything, that you just couldn't sort of discern from a distance on what was actually happening, whether the caribou were kind of starting to head north or not. And so what we decided to do is we flew in to a small village in the Yukon called Old Crow, and it's a Gwich'in village, Gwich'in being a sort of band of Athabascan native people who have lived up there for and their survival has been tied to the caribou for over 10,000 years now. And so these people, it's a small town, a handful of trucks that have been flown or barged in over the years. It sits along the Porcupine River, and on every table of the 400 residents, as we went into their small cabins, there'd be a bowl of dried caribou meat out back. There'd be caribou skins hanging from the hunts the fall before, and everybody, the talk on the street would be like, in the rest of Canada during the hockey playoffs, but it wasn't about hockey, it was about caribou movement. And so these people are incredibly attuned to when the caribou might be through and which direction they might be going. But a lot of that talk, we soon realized, was very speculative. And people were within an hour of us arriving and asking questions about where caribou might be and what they might be doing. We got a whole host of answers, everything from that we were already too late, they'd already been through and over the Porcupine River, well north, to people saying we're way too early and we should wait till May, which is in early April. So Leanne and I immediately are sort of plunged into the state of confusion and back and forth. And then we happened upon this gentleman that figures very prominently as a character in the book at the beginning and the end, Randall Tetlici, a 50-something-year-old Gwich'in man, and he'd been out hunting the day before, and he had got a few caribou. And so we ended up at his doorstep and talked about what we'd like to set off and do. And, he didn't have any immediate answers, and he didn't offer any opinions, unlike a lot of the other people we'd run into. And he was very quiet and soft-spoken. But there was something about the look he gave us and the way he invited us in, and we had a lunch of caribou soup that really sort of told Leanne and I that this was somebody whose advice we should listen very closely to. It was more of it's hard to articulate, it was more of a sense or a feeling than anything else. And so over the course of the afternoon, he agreed that the next day he would take us to this place where he'd been hunting about 60 miles outside of town. And we would go by snowmobile the next morning. And so off we headed, and sure enough, later that day, we encountered groups of hundreds of caribou crossing the river in the same spot. And yet, as we pitched camp that night, it was in a small trapper's cabin along the river, and the river's frozen at this time, of course. We're all uncertain, and even Randall's uncertain, whether indeed the caribou are migrating or not. And that night it gets dark, and we end up around the table by candlelight, and there's a small fire going in the wood stove. And Randall starts to tell all these incredible stories about times when he'd been hunting and his boat had blown up and burned, and he'd had to do a combination of swimming and walking for weeks to get back to town. And stories about his grandfather, who had always known when to send out Randall and his brothers to go hunting, when the caribou would be coming through, and just the incredible power that he had. And Randall for giving us advice on the journey that lay ahead, and probably one of the most important pieces of advice he gave us was to listen to our dreams, to pay attention to our dreams. And that night, there was some old caribou skin hides lying around the cabin, and I made a nice bed for Leanne. And so she went to sleep, and I slept on the floor. Randall slept on the bunk on the other side. And the next morning, we woke up and still uncertain, no caribou in sight now, still uncertain, should we head off and follow them, or should we still wait? And then Leanne recalled that she had a dream that night, and the dream had been of the Porcupine River, which was covered in, you know, a sheet of ice many feet thick and capped with snow at this point. She had a dream that that river had broken up. It had started to melt and flow. And that dream, like, I was kind of skeptical, you know, here this native man had told us to pay attention to our dreams the night before, and now all of a sudden my wife was having this dream. And what did it all mean? And was it very believable? But Leanne's look assured me that it was true. Indeed, it was a very vivid dream. And I looked at Randall, and he had none of that sort of questioning or doubt in his eyes, and he just sort of quietly said, well, there's your answer. You guys got to get going. And so literally we packed up, and we found the most well-trodden trail that left the river, and we followed that up the first hill into our first forest and took our first footsteps, and that was how this incredible journey started.
Whenever you're ready, you can listen to the rest of the journey. It's a full hour and a half long reliving of this amazing tale. You can find the links to the next segment on today's website or anytime at wildsidenews.com. Just click on the Animal Archives and listen to the rest of Being Caribou. Coming up, another path to adventure as a young scientist starts his journey to discover if apes have any intelligence. What's he find out? Stay tuned.
The river's on the rise, swift and gentle like the breeze. It swallows everything but sky. It suffocates the trees. Here comes the water. Should I struggle or give in? And does it even matter if I sing? If I sink, if I sink or swim,
melting polar ice was a dirty look, shrinking glaciers, a nudge, then dying coral reefs pushed us hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sidney Wildsmith.
Some of the best stories in life take time to tell, and the Wildside News regularly brings you novel-length shows that listen like a good book. Coming up, an animal behaviorist determines to find out if apes have any real intelligence, and he spends years watching and recording the responses by various apes to his computer screens and levers, and then his world changes as he suddenly finds himself inside the mystery of the minds of our closest relatives. Stay tuned for another great story when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News. sometimes it feels as if I'm caught between two worlds. It's no secret that I have a passion for promoting the concept that animals are exceptional beings with great abilities and wonder. And a comforting truth is that almost anyone who has a pet, particularly a dog, or a reasonable cat, or a larger bird like a parrot, will tell you in no uncertain terms that yes, animals are really intelligent. Take a moment to talk with a dog owner about their pet, and you will soon hear a series of amazing stories of their sensitivity, cleverness, loyalty, and intelligence. But the other side of this story is that science, for a long time, has held to the belief, much growing from the legacy of Darwin and evolution, that animals could not have real intelligence because, well, for example, in order to think and reason, they would have to have the use of words. And we all know they don't use words. And when we assign human characteristics to animal behavior, we are anthropomorphizing. Well, today's feature is a wonderful story of science and the quest for truth. It's a story of the evolution of scientific understanding, where pure science explores the question of animal intelligence. There is a giant opportunity for all of us to learn what happens when science, pure science, holds to the quest. This just may be one of the most significant stories presented so far on the Wild Side News, and I invite you all to take this journey of discovery. You will be glad you did.
We're talking with Dr. Duane M. Rumbaugh, who co-authored the book Intelligence of Apes and Other Rational Beings with Dr. David A. Washburn. The book is published by Yale University Press. Dr. Rumbaugh, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you.
You're working with the Great Ape Trust, and I certainly would like to start out with you giving a little heads up on what's happening with the Great Ape Trust, because this is ultimately where what we're going to talk about today has led you.
Well, the Great Ape Trust is a great adventure. We are trying to organize a new entity that will give a new and effective message to the world about the importance of our world of nature, using the great apes really as our point of focus. The great apes are so closely related to us, so much alike in their mentality, though different somewhat in their morphology from us, that we really need to put emphasis on conserving them in nature so that their culture, their modes of living will be available forever for subsequent generations to study and to learn from. We can conserve them in captivity, but we really deprive ourselves, if that's our only access to them, to learning about how it is that they live in nature. And that's a very important book for us to continue reading.
I believe that, as a matter of fact, that's what your research has led to, is that conclusion, that is the importance that they be allowed to exist in their natural environments for reasons that we'll get into. How did you come to be so involved with researching intelligence in apes?
It's a long and interesting story. As a boy, I loved animals, particularly dogs. I worked on the farm during World War II and pretty much lost my love of animals, in that animals on the farm are basically food products and beasts of labor, at least they were then. We were still using horses a lot. And then when I went to college and to graduate school in psychology, I came to be intrigued with the process of learning and learning theories. Learning theories then emphasized reinforcement, that the reinforcement of responses really in some way bonded responses and behavior to stimuli or to environmental events, and that organisms basically were empty and without rational processes. And there's a lot of power to be exercised through the use of reinforcement or through manipulating the consequences of behaviors. But I felt at the time that there still was something incomplete in that the magnificent work of Curler and Yerkes were viewed pretty much as points of intrigue, but nothing to be taken too seriously other than ways of thinking in the course of history. Now, both Curler and Yerkes were of the opinion that the great apes were different and that they had the capacity of insight of basic reasoning processes. And this stood in contrast to the radical behavioral thinking of theorists of that time, earlier Thorndike and Watson, and then Skinner and Hull, and in measure Tolman, though he was far more rational in his perspective of animals' behavior than were the others. But at any rate, I got my master's degree in experimental psychology from Kent State, and then my PhD from University of Colorado at Boulder, studying with students of K.W. Spence of the University of Iowa. Spence was the main disciple of Clark Hull, who of Yale University advanced the concept of the development of habit strength and stimulus-response connections, reinforcement of responses through need reduction, and so on. With my PhD in hand, I went to work with San Diego State College, as it was then called, in 1954, and various interesting events of history led me to apply for a direct commission in the United States Navy, which I got in 1957 or 58, and then was on duty at the Naval Research Medical Center in Bethesda, Maryland, right alongside of the Naval Hospital there. And that summer, I worked with Lieutenant Bob Vos on a project to put some kind of biological experiment in space. That introduced me to work with small primates, squirrel monkeys and cotton-top marmosets. I decided that I was at the ripe old age of 28, too old to convert from a college professorial life to that of the United States Navy, so I didn't go for a career in the Navy. I went back to my teaching job and went to the San Diego Zoo, not far away, with a new perspective, namely of wanting to better understand the great apes and the evolution, the emergence of intelligence in the primate forms that they had in their beautiful collection of primates, ranging from prosimians to New World monkeys, Old World monkeys, the lesser apes, and the great apes. I took my class down there frequently to look at the primates and almost invariably invited Dr. George Purnell, an anthropologist and curator of the mammals at the zoo. I invited him to talk with us about the primates, and he was just great always. When he would move from the prosimians and the monkeys to the lesser apes and then to the great apes, something of an ascending scale of an approximation of what we are, he would always say, as he would point to the great apes, he said, well, now these are thinking animals. And I always thought to myself, oh, yeah, yeah, George, they're thinking animals, all right. Animals can't think. They don't have language. They're not human. It's all conditioned responses. It's all based on reinforcement. But I never said that to him out of respect.
You know, scientists are almost confined to that to that response.
Yes,
response.
Yes, we had indeed been strongly reinforced in that.
The concept that animals, you know, any time that someone might suggest, you might suggest that animals have feelings or awareness, then the charge of anthropomorphizing would hit you, and that's a killer.
That was a killer then, and it's less of a killer now. But to it, I always like to reply, well, we anthropomorphize with one another all the time as humans. I don't really know that you are a rational being. I don't know that really that I'm talking with anybody who is other than some kind of a biological invention from outer space.
Some people claim that is the case with me at times, yeah.
I assume, we each assume, that we are rational beings, that we are sentient, that we have logic, that this and that and the other. But that's really, really on faith, and really groundless assumptions. We make the bold assumption that what people say is really what they mean, and that is risky. Many times we say what we don't mean. This morning I've spent a lot of time communicating with a friend, clarifying a point of psychology that I was trying to make yesterday. And I've had a lot of fun doing it with him, and he with me. It's part of our professional exchange.
Well, getting back to this concept of your beginnings in the research into intelligence, and I really appreciate this book is a very honest story of your emergence into your beliefs about animal intelligence. And it's really, to me, it's fascinating because at that time, as you began to work at the San Diego Zoo, you approached this from almost a Skinnerian, and you'll be better at defining the approach, but you really felt that you had to use very extremely controlled testing, and so you began with apes in laboratories.
Yes, and I did, but it was really much more of a Harlovian approach at that point. I had become disinterested in Hull's reinforcement perspective about 1956 as I worked with rats. I just finally gave up, concluding that it wasn't going to work with me, that the rats were always learning more than I did. I could not predict accurately the outcome of an experiment. But in 1949, Harry Harlow at the University of Wisconsin came forth with his phenomenon of learning set, learning how to learn. And it was brilliant work in that he showed with rhesus macaque monkeys, with macaque monkeys, not all of which were rhesus, that they could be transformed, if you would, from stimulus response reinforcement learners to one trial insightful learners, with a one trial insightful learning being one of the criteria for really curlers and Yerkes insightful learning for their creativity in their behaviors. So this intrigued me, and I set about to study the formation of learning sets in primates from prosimians through the great apes, and that took 10 years to do. In fact, it continued well beyond there. But some very interesting things came forth from there. The animals taught me some things that just couldn't possibly be true in how they would develop learning sets. And if I may risk translating the basic lesson into words, and it's difficult always to do, it is that as the various primate forms learned increasing amounts in terms of accuracy of choices correct in a situation, they differed markedly in terms of how they could transfer that learning to subsequent situations in which there was some change. The situation to which they transferred was similar to and yet different from the one in which they learned. And this remarkable phenomenon was first seen by work with I and my colleague at the San Diego Zoo when I was on sabbatical leave and took a look at the results with squirrel monkeys. On the one hand, a very diminutive New World monkey compared to that of the great apes with the same procedures. Namely, that as the amount of their learning increased, the squirrel monkeys invariably did worse on their transfer tests. Learning more for them cost them in terms of their accuracy of performance in the transfer tests. To the contrary, with the great apes, the more they knew, the more probable it was that they would do not really just as well. They would do better on the transfer test than what they had done in the original learning situation.
Let me just give a little background, too, because I think painting a picture here would help the listeners really appreciate what the type of experience. You worked in a laboratory environment where you created the lexigraphs that were little boxes that could help the monkeys and apes make choices And so this some of the first levels was just to prove that an animal could recognize different shapes and forms. And
yes.
I mean, it was very fundamental,
yes.
But because it was science, you had to start with fundamentals. And so you were really just trying to suggest in the initial research that animals could actually recognize anything.
And well, it was known that they could recognize things, but what wasn't known was that as they learned how to learn, as they developed, if you will, proficiency in learning tasks of a given type, it wasn't known that they really differed all that much.
Hmm.
And my study was designed to see whether or not they did.
Hmm.
And they did differ profoundly. And the larger the primate brain, and here we're talking about species, not individuals, the better they were at transferring what they had learned from one situation to another.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this stark contrast that the great apes could be significantly better in transferring what they've learned, whereas for the small-brained primates, they were significantly worse in their transfer tests.
Help people understand what that means, this
yes,
concept of transfer.
I was just going to say mm-hmm. what we mean by that. Let me use an example here to everyday life. When we drive cars of different makes, there is fundamentally positive transfer from one make to another. We know that the key will go in some slot generally to the right of the steering wheel. We know that there is a shifting mechanism of some kind, generally, though with the new hybrids, I guess that's going out, I don't know. We know that there is a brake that is foot-controlled, and that it's with the right foot, not the left foot, and so on, and that there's an accelerator. If it weren't that cars are fundamentally designed the same way, it would be impossible for us to slip into a new car and to drive it without a lot of lessons. Now, as we made a shift in cars from having the gear shift mechanism on the floor to on the steering wheel, there was a lot of negative transfer. People weren't used to finding first gear when the shifting mechanism was on the steering wheel. When it became automatic, that became really no problem. But sometimes the transfer was negative, and thus I remember very definitely, and I'm sure everybody does, who learned how to drive in cars that had a clutch on the floor and a brake on the floor, and that we had to press the clutch in before we shifted gears. When the clutch was taken out of the car and we wanted to shift gears, we found our left foot flailing around down
yeah.
there for a pedal that just wasn't there. Well, that's negative transfer.
Mm-hmm.
Then we had to shift our attention to, well, how is it now that we shift gears?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes transfer can be so negative that it takes lives. When I was in the Naval Reserves, I knew of a pilot who creamed in with his fighter jet one weekend. And the reason that it happened in the post-accident analysis was that the flap mechanism was where the throttle had been on the previous plane that he had really been an accomplished flyer in and with. And as he made his approach to landing, he needed more power. Instead, he applied more flaps, and that cost him support that he had, and he stalled and crashed in. So positive and negative transfer are basic to our lives.
One of the things I think would be interesting is to kind of, as I say, you started out with very basic research, just trying to indicate that these animals had some level of comprehension. But
yes.
then your book certainly chronicles the way in which, as you experimented, you know, over years with the different animals,
yes.
that you began to, first of all, begin to prove, as well as sense, that there was a lot more going on. And we can kind
yeah.
of take this to the next step. For example, some people have said, well, can animals use tools? Or can animals actually understand language? Or do they have a language?
Yes.
Obviously, if they were just beast machines, the theory was they
yes.
they couldn't or
yes.
they wouldn't. So tell us about some of the breakthroughs for you as you moved through the years that would lead to your own beliefs about those things.
Mm-hmm. Just one more comment on the positive-negative transfer, because it's absolutely basic here.
Mm-hmm.
If an organism, especially a non-human organism, can transfer what it learns in one situation to another to a profound advantage, doing better in it than what it had done in the original learning situation, that strongly suggests that it has some comprehension of what it has learned,
mm-hmm.
that it's learned principles and not specifics.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's
by
not
contrast,
just reacting.
If an animal mm-hmm. does less well in the transfer test mm-hmm. than what it did in the original learning, it strongly suggests that it's learned specifics and really can't generalize what it's learned in any kind of a rational or principled way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is absolutely basic, I believe, to the emergence of intelligence and to language and to tool use and to every other manifestation that we view as inventive. We know that animals can use tools. They can create tools. Through the work of Sue Savage Rumbaugh, we know that Kanzi, a bonobo ape, a form of chimpanzee, can make stone tools that are of the kind that early humans made to cut meat, to skin animals, to do this and that. And he learned it by imitation. That is really not just imitation. He learned it by observing Professor Nick Toth and Kathy Schick from Indiana University making tools out of flint. He developed all of the finesse not by the specifics of watching them, but by starting with what he could see them do. And then his own experience taught him how to really make a fine flint tool. Now, that is profound for an animal to do. Neither Sue nor anybody else other than Nick Toth thought that an ape might make a stone tool like that.
That's extraordinary.
But they can. They can do all kinds of things. They can learn some of the aspects of language. Now, there's a big quarrel in the field. There has been for the past half century. Well, you know, it really isn't language because humans can do this and they can do that. Well, I would hope that they can. You know, apes' brains are about the third the size of ours, and they are apes. They're not humans. But the really exciting thing is that there is some overlap in our language capabilities and what the great apes can learn, not from being taught as though they were beast machines, but by being reared as though they're something they're not, namely being reared in part as though they were a child.
So what happens next? You can find out by following the links to the rest of the story, or when you're ready, it's always there for you on wildsidenews.com. Go to the Animal Archives and continue the story of the Great Ape Trust. There are hundreds of amazing stories and discussions whenever you need that connection with the truth of our world. Now next week, we get ready for the Washington Wilderness Week as we explore the emerging new spirit of wilderness that is taking back our world. We'll be back next Thursday, or anytime on the archives, when your voice of the earth continues. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again here on the Wild Side News.